Wisconsin has a tripartite form of government, three separate but equal branches, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Wisconsin's constitution created a separation of the powers, giving each branch exclusive core powers and the power to check and balance one another. We're looking at these core powers and the distribution of power among the branches here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In state politics this month, we heard Democrats calling out what they saw was a power grab in the lame duck legislative session. It put the spotlight on the balance of power between branches of government, and it led us to question about how these powers work in concert. So let's go to Howard Schwaber. He is a professor of political science and legal studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's an expert in constitutional law, judicial politics, and American politics. Howard, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So the way we do it here in Wisconsin, this model of three different branches, that's not the only way you can set up government. There are different models out there for separating powers?
Well, that's right. And in fact, the manner in which powers are distributed among branches of government is one of the real fundamental principles or fundamental distinctions among different forms of government. Take a really simple case in a parliamentary form of government. The executive, or what they just call the government, is formed directly out of the parliament, and the norm is something called responsible government, and the key is that at all times parliament should control the actions of the executive. That's very, very different, obviously, from our standard American understanding, which goes back to Montesquieu, of three branches, actually it goes back earlier to writers like Polybius in the Roman period, of three different branches of government exercising some degree of check on one another, and of course that was very well developed by James Madison. To give a really interesting side note on this, we tend to think of the American Revolution as a revolution against a tyrannical king, and of course that's true, but going all the way back to the 17th century and even before in England, the fight over what would be the division of authority between Parliament and the king was a matter of raging debate, and one that was at the core of the issues that gave rise to the American Revolution. And to take just one example about how differently things can work. In 1642, Parliament sends a set of propositions to King Charles I, and among other things demands that the Privy Council, which we'd call the cabinet, has to be consulted on a whole series of decisions and has the authority to overrule the king. That is, there was this notion that the cabinet was a check on the king.
Sounding eerily familiar to what's going on in state politics in 2018, perhaps?
Well, there are echoes of that, and with reason, because, of course, in the U.S. federal model, that's not how we see things. And in fact, one of the most famous phrases in the U.S. federal model is the unitary executive. And this is something that the federal level, in modern politics, Republicans and conservatives in particular tend to support. And that's the idea that the president, or the executive branch, must be solely under the control of the president, especially the cabinet, for example. So authority to choose and dismiss cabinet members or agency heads. You might remember the controversy over the Consumer Protection Banking Bureau that was alleged to be unconstitutional because its head answered to Congress, not to the president. And the Republicans' claim in that situation was this violates the idea of the unitary executive. And that's an idea that goes back at least to Jackson. So the American model starts with an exceptionally strong, at the federal level, an exceptionally strong notion of three branches of government, each with distinct and unique powers, and then overlapping areas of authority as checks and balances. But that's not how the states worked.
Yeah, bring that framework now to Wisconsin and right, where we are today.
Well, both in Wisconsin and elsewhere, many states experimented with many different forms of separation of powers, and it's not at all the case that the federal model is uniformly reproduced. So Wisconsin's constitution, when it's adopted in 1848, does establish three branches of government. There's nothing in the Wisconsin constitution that uses a phrase like separation of powers. That phrase also doesn't exist in the U.S. constitution. These are ways of thinking that are implied by a certain structural arrangement. As early as 1873, there's Wisconsin Supreme Court cases asking the question, when does one branch intrude on another? And there's this long body of federal and Wisconsin law. And basically, issues of separation of powers, when they're constitutional issues at the state or the federal level, tend to fall into one of two categories, known as collision and collusion. So collision is when the two of the branches of government are at loggerheads. And trying to prevent each other from doing their jobs. And collusion is where one branch deliberately tries to give up power to another, and they cooperate in a way that reduces the checks and balances issues. In Wisconsin, there's an exceptionally fluid system of separation of powers. In fact, among all the states, Wisconsin allows nearly the most overlap of powers among the branches. So, for example, the governor has what we'd call a line item veto or a partial veto of appropriations bills. Conversely, that veto can be overruled by a two-thirds vote in only one house, whichever house was the originating house of the bill. Appointments powers, legislative oversight powers, across a wide range of issues, at the state level, the Wisconsin Constitution actually has among the most fluid and weakest barriers separating the branches of the government in the interests of allowing them to act as checks on one another and to cooperate.
So recently, Governor Walker, when signing the bills for the lame duck legislative session, he brought out visual aids intended to look like a Venn diagram to show the powers at work. That didn't exactly work out for him.
No, that's not how Venn diagrams work.
But regardless, it really brought to light what core powers are doing and who's doing what in these branches.
Right. So in the Wisconsin case, there are several different ways of looking at the current controversy. There is an argument, and some of the Republican leadership has been making this argument, that in fact, previously the Wisconsin legislature delegated or granted too much power to Governor Walker. That'd be one of those collusion situations. And so this is merely a corrective of what was a state constitutional error to begin with. The collusion level, of course, is that now the legislature is claiming authority to interfere with what have been various areas of gubernatorial authority. And so the question comes down to exactly the one that you identified in the introduction, which is what are the core powers of each branch of government? In the case of the executive, for example, one of those core powers is the powers to see that the law, or the authority, or the responsibility to see that the law is executed. And in a case in North Carolina, coming out of 2016, which was very similar to the situation that we face now in Wisconsin, the North Carolina Supreme Court found that appointments to boards, state government boards, must rest with the governor so that the governor can control the process of the enforcement of laws and regulations. In this case, that would be an argument that the legislature went too far in stripping Governor Evers of appointment authority with respect to economic development boards, for example. There's a background notion here that's deeply rooted in U.S. constitutional law, that the executive authority or responsibility, because they're one and the same, to faithfully execute the laws fundamentally implies an authority to decide when not to execute the laws, prosecutorial discretion. And an authority to decide how laws shall be enforced and implemented. And so, for example, the Wisconsin Supreme Court may very well look at this appointment issue and the specific question of the Foxconn agreement with the Wisconsin government and say that the determination of how those things should be carried out must rest with the governor, because implementing policy is part of the governor's responsibility. And that's amplified by what I described before as fluid lines of division between the branches. In a 1940s case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court referred to the governor as having quasi-legislative powers. So in the Wisconsin system, there's a strong idea that a governor does carry a policy agenda, even more strong than is present in the federal understanding. And that could be a powerful argument against the Republicans' moves in this instance, just as the argument against excessive delegation and the idea of a correction of against this idea of interbranch collusion is probably the strongest legal argument in favor of what they've done.
Howard Schwaber breaking it down for us. We're looking at the powers of government, how power is carried by the branches of government. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about our state government, how it's structured, how it works? What do you think of the moves made by Republicans to curtail Governor-elect Tony Evers' power? Do you view it as a reduction of power? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a minute on the Ideas Network. There is a great deal of overlap in the powers of the three separate branches of Wisconsin government, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has described Wisconsin's government as a system of separateness but interdependence. We're talking about the powers and how they work with one another here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Howard Schwaber is our guide to this conversation. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. focusing on constitutional law, judicial politics, and American politics. Gathering your insights and questions, they're welcome in the discussion at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the moves made by Republicans to curtail Governor-elect Tony Evers' power? Do you feel that it's an unfair play that runs contrary to the will of the people? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Howard, I want to spend a little bit of time here on Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who said in the past that making the legislative branch equally as important as the governor has been a goal of him as speaker. And he said in an interview last week with the publication Governing that it's unfortunate people have focused on the timing of this legislation. And he said, everyone knows in our system today the executive is the most powerful branch of the three, and the legislative branch holds the power of the purse. So has Voss moved the needle on his goal?
Well, to describe that as Robin Voss's goal requires some pretty dramatic rewriting of history. Certainly during the period when Governor Walker was governor, that was not on the horizon at all, nor was it an informing principle of any of the moves that Voss took. The other problem is to say, well, this is merely a focus on timing, is to minimize the nature of the timing. It was an all-night session that ended at 5 o'clock in the morning. These bills were presented with zero possibility or time for public review. So the manner in which this was done smacked of a power grab, regardless of the content. And I think that's one thing that has people upset. The needle has been moved to some extent in resetting the relationship between the legislature and the executive, whether we want to ascribe this to Voss or to some or not. And the question, as always, is was the needle too far in one direction before, and has it moved too far at present? Again, in each of the systems we mentioned briefly at the beginning, there's a balance struck between separating powers and overlapping powers. You need overlap for there to be checks and balances. You need separation for there to be autonomy for each of the branches of government. And where to strike that balance is always the question.
Let's go to Mary now, joining us from Lancaster. Hi, Mary.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I basically have the same comment as your speaker was saying, is that it's a complete power grab. If it had been that Walker was still going to be still in office, those laws wouldn't have been changed. And it's the same thing that's going in our national capital, and that it's a power grab. They interpret the Constitution however they want to remain in power.
Mary, thanks for the call. Interpreting the Constitution, very subjective.
Well, it can be. So Mary made actually two really interesting points that I think are worth emphasizing. One is this is a national phenomenon. What's happening in Wisconsin is part of a national Republican strategy. We've also seen it in North Carolina. We've seen it in Michigan. We're starting to see the same program being undertaken or something like it in Florida. So it's very evident there is a national program of making these sorts of moves to recalibrate the constitutional relations among the branches in situations where Democrats have taken control of the executive branch, but Republicans maintain the legislature. So I think Mary's absolutely right to point this as a national phenomenon. And it is a bit of a power grab in the sense that no one doubts, and in fact, Speaker Fitzgerald has been very explicit about this, had Walker remained in power, these moves would not have been taken. The desire to adjust the relationship among the branches is driven by concern that a Democratic governor will bring a liberal agenda or a Democratic agenda. So all of that is correct. The question, though, is whether this is ordinary politics or perhaps a particularly hardball version of ordinary politics, because it's certainly extreme, but whether it's politics or whether it rises to the level of violating the Constitution, because the state constitutions allow a great deal of leeway and a great deal of flexibility in how these powers are distributed. And there's a sharp distinction between saying this looks like a power grab or this looks like bare-knuckled politics and calling people sore losers or whatever complaints one wants to make. That's different from making the assertion this violates the Wisconsin Constitution. And that's a harder case to make.
Can you make the case?
One can. You'd have to go through particular provisions. As I said, I think one of the more vulnerable elements is the idea of stripping the governor of appointment authority. Another is trying to limit the authority of the attorney general to make decisions about when to withdraw from lawsuits or how to proceed in legal matters. Again, this comes down to the executive's control over how laws are enforced and carried out and how their legal mandates are carried out. And that has been recognized at least certainly at the federal level, certainly in other states, and at least implicitly in some Wisconsin cases, that has been recognized as one of those core executive functions. So from a constitutional perspective, that's a piece that I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court might find goes too far.
Paul in Eau Claire emailed to ask, we elected a U.S. House to check national executive power, but the Wisconsin state legislature shouldn't check state executive power. Isn't that a double standard?
Well, Paul makes two really good points. I guess that's a theme for me. First, if a very important point is that you can't draw a direct analogy between the federal and the state systems because they're different. We have a different notion of separation of powers and a different notion of the divided branches of government in Wisconsin than the one that prevails at the federal level. And focusing on those differences is really informative. Secondly, of course, Paul is absolutely correct. In any system, the federal or the Wisconsin, the idea is that the legislature will act as a check on the executive, but also that the executive will act as a check on the legislature. And again, it's a matter of striking the right balance. If too much power is taken away from the executive and grabbed by the legislature, right, then that version of checks and balances is weakened. Paul also points to the idea of an inconsistency. There is a really clear inconsistency, at least rhetorically here, in that at the federal level, Republicans and conservatives tend to favor what I previously called the unitary executive model, a very strongly independent executive branch under the direct control of the president. At the state level, at least in Michigan and North Carolina and Wisconsin, Republicans have taken the opposite position. But of course, you can point to the fact that Democrats have tended to fall on the opposite side of both of those debates.
Well, let's look a little bit at the judicial branch. How much are members of the judicial branch, in effect, legislating from the bench? How much of an impact do we see there?
Well, that's a very broad question.
Yeah.
Let's focus on just this particular issue and imagine what will happen when it reaches the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So the Wisconsin Supreme Court is actually very reticent, historically, to step into debates of this kind, except to ensure that there is separation of powers. So, for example, we all remember, I think, Governor Walker's Act 10, the law having to do with unions and so on. That was, there was a state district court judge who enjoined publication of the law, that is, prevented it from being published and therefore going into effect, and the Supreme Court said that was a usurpation. It's not a one-time thing. Governor Thompson had a lawsuit between himself and the Wisconsin Senate over the question of the operation of the line item veto. I've mentioned our cases back to the 1940s and the 1910s and even one as far back as the 1870s. And there's a very consistent pattern. The Wisconsin court will not act so long as the question is one about the internal operations of the legislature, something like an open meetings law. It will not allow courts to step in to interfere with the legislative process. Once a law is in place, however, it is the duty of the court to review its constitutionality. And so in the event that this court were to find a clear usurpation of core executive functions, then that would not be legislation. That is the basic function of reviewing courts.
Let's go to Mark now in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I think part of this, the context of this should also be seen what happened with the Supreme Court nomination of Merrick Garland back in 2016. Republican Party insisted that we couldn't have this nomination in a quote-unquote election year. We had to wait and see what the people voted. So in Wisconsin, we had an election. We voted for a new governor. We also voted for a new district attorney that you haven't spoken about, whose powers have also been greatly reduced. And so, but somehow, so the one consistency is that Republicans must remain in power, that elections have consequences, but only when Republicans win.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. What do you see there?
Well, no one is going to receive a Nobel Prize for discovering the existence of hypocrisy in politics. To be shocked by that requires a very low threshold of surprise. And, of course, hypocrisy is a bipartisan and universal practice. He's certainly correct that, and one could go much further in lots of other examples. For example, what happened when Walker was elected and insisted the legislature should not take actions during the lame duck period. Right? But that is endemic to politics. I think Mark's point is a striking one when he mentioned the Merrick Garland nomination. One of the pieces we have not talked about is the increasing politicization of the judiciary. This is Clip in North Carolina, for example, which I mentioned before, is a place where a lot of these things are tried out first. So there's a whole raft of things going on. In and of itself, I don't think that makes this constitutionally illegitimate. It does give everything a bad flavor. And I think the real concern here is not so much the formal constitutional issue as the idea that people are starting to genuinely lose faith in the legitimacy of the political process. And for Wisconsin, that's a shocking development.
Governor Walker said in a tweet that even with the new bills, the governor of Wisconsin will still be, quote, one of the most powerful chief executives in the country. We're exploring that system of check and balance and how power is distributed between branches of Wisconsin government. You're with us on the morning show. Howard Schwaber is our guide. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. Your insights are welcome at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about our government, how power is distributed, and how a branch can check another? You can call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back after a news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said the lame duck session earlier this month was about restoring the balance of power in Wisconsin. He maintains that the maneuver was a nonpartisan attempt to restore balance between the branches. So we're getting a better grasp of how this power is divided up between branches of government. Howard Schwaber is with us. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. Getting your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Has rebalancing powers been a longstanding concern for you? How do you think this rebalance will play out when the legislature reconvenes? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's start out by going back to the phones now with Mark joining us from New Berlin. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Say, I think a lot of people have a short memory. When Governor Walker was elected, the Democrats left the state so that there was no legislation that could be done. And almost immediately afterwards, they demanded a recall. It's really strange. And I guess the other thing I thought of was that the way election results are presented, we always hear things like 49-51%. Even when there's four and five candidates, what do we do with those other votes when you're saying that? I don't hear that. I don't see it on the TV. NPR doesn't talk about it. We had libertarians running. We had Green Party people running. But we always get a total that comes up to 100 if we talk about just Republicans and Democrats.
Mark, thanks so much for the question.
All right, so two different questions there.
Yeah.
On the issue of, you know, the hardball tactics the Democrats used when Governor Walker was elected and began to initiate his agenda. Sure, as I mentioned earlier, both parties engage in hardball politics. There's a question as to whether this crosses a different line. And the question is, and it's a question, is this a matter of merely playing by the rules or changing the rules? And if it's the latter, that would feel a little bit different. More importantly, though, the question is, in this case, are the Republicans effectively changing the state constitution in response to an electoral outcome? And the idea that the Constitution's design responds to political outcomes rather than dictating political outcomes is really a fundamental reversal in the way we think about the institutions of governance. There's no question Democrats play political hardball. There's no question Democrats engage in pushing, you know, tactics to try and push an agenda or stop an agenda, just as Republicans do. What we're seeing this year, though, across the nation in a series of states, is unprecedented in the degree to which it appears to be an organized strategy, but more importantly, in the degree to which it really seems to be to involve the idea that the political organization dictated by the Constitution is based on parties rather than other structural interests. And one very good example is that Governor Walker, among others, has dismissed the outcome of the gubernatorial election on the ground that it was mostly the result of votes from Madison and Milwaukee.
But how did lame duck sessions, extraordinary sessions, come into practice?
Oh, lame duck sessions have always been with us. It's unusual to have one of these overnight sessions, but it's been done before at the federal level and at the state level. You know, the manner in which this legislation was adopted really strikes me as kind of standard hardball politics. Sure, you can accuse people on both sides of hypocrisy in their outrage, but it's the content that is potentially disturbing. And again, if I have to come back to a particular idea, we're talking about separation of powers because that's a constitutional aspect of the system of government, not a policy outcome. And if the system is adjusted to support certain or thwart policy goals rather than dictating the possibility of policy goals, that's a real, you know, dog and tail revert, the tail wagging the dog kind of thing.
Let's go to Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, good morning.
Morning. Yes, I was interested to find out when the governor acquired the powerful line item veto authority and why the legislature gave up so much bargaining power with the governor, and how do we get back to a more federal type system where he either has to veto it or let it pass?
Jimmy, thanks for the question. Line item vetoes, how did that evolve?
Right, so it isn't actually a line item veto in the strict sense of the term. The governor of Wisconsin has the authority to engage in something like a line item veto only with respect to appropriations bills. That power was gained in 1930. There have been adjustments as recently as the 2000s. I don't have the date right in front of me, but I believe in 2008 there was an amendment, a very, very specific amendment that said the governor may not alter two sentences of a bill so as to create one new sentence. So right down to the level of words and letters, the governor has the authority to proofread and edit appropriations bills, but there are principles that say he or she cannot do so in a way that would change the purpose and meaning of the bills. The reason for granting that authority is actually a matter of some debate. There are two general accounts that are given. One is to avoid log rolling, to avoid the kind of omnibus budget bills that we see so often at the federal level, where, for example, funding for a border wall might be attached to a farm bill.
Pork barrel.
One hypothetical example. Well, pork barrel refers more to local spending to benefit a district. But this idea of taking unrelated matters and latching them onto an essential bill so that people will have no choice but to pass it, which has become an absolutely standard strategy at the federal level, particularly with respect to budgets. Pork barreling is relevant because the way a budget gets larded up with preferential bits is because you have to vote on the bill as a whole. It's a 700-page bill, and so you have to give everybody their goodies and their pet priorities in order to get the bill through. The U.S. Congress experimented with a line item veto. It was one of the very bipartisan moments when a Republican Congress granted that authority to President Clinton, and the Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional over some stinging dissents. But it's striking that Congress and the Wisconsin legislature alike are actually quite willing to give up a degree of that kind of authority to the executive, precisely because they recognize the pathologies involved in the legislative process if you have to do everything all at once.
Let's go to Patrick now in Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, good morning. My question is, what would we need to do so that we could have ballot referenda that have the enforcement of law like California does, where they pass a referendum and the government has to implement it? What do we need to do in Wisconsin to get a system like that?
Amend the Constitution. A number of these questions have very short answers, and I think I've skipped a couple. But in a couple of instances, questions have been raised that go to the specific constitutional design of Wisconsin. And as I mentioned at the outset, Wisconsin's system is different from those of other states. There's a lot of variety among states. Wisconsin does have particularly fluid boundaries separating the powers of the branches of the government and a variety of other features. I'm not certain that I would be eager to embrace directly enforceable referenda. California's record with that has been mixed. And nationally, there's a lot of debate about the value of that kind of direct democracy. I did want to come back to a point that was raised by an earlier caller about the role of gerrymandering.
Yeah, go ahead.
In all this.
Actually, on that call, Nate in Milwaukee can set us off there. Nate, go ahead.
Oh, hi, thank you. I was going to say that gerrymandering actually, among the other points I was going to mention, gerrymandering reduces the accountability of the state legislature to the people, so that when you are basically giving all these powers to the legislature, you're giving them to the branch that is currently the least, and by that, maybe not at all, accountable to the people. I was also going to mention the Attorney General for the changes there, and that if there's a company that some way harms a number of people in the state, the Attorney General could take that company to the court and then get sort of funds to pay those people back. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the way they've been changing it, now the state legislature could potentially stop the Attorney General from trying to take that company to court. And even if the Attorney General did, they could grab any funds that the Attorney General gets out of that court case and use them for something totally different.
Nate, thanks so much for calling in. First on the gerrymandering.
Right. So this is an important, and we're straying a little from the constitutional legal issues, but I think it gets directly at a fundamental issue about state constitutions and variations among constitutions. The political background to these moves in Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina that I'm talking about is the gerrymander. Wisconsin is one of the strictest, and it's been described as a nearly perfect gerrymander, such that the Republican majorities in the two houses of the state legislature are almost unassailable. They're almost impervious to political change. It's estimated it would require a 10-point shift, which is sort of seismic, historical kind of event, to overcome the effects of the Wisconsin gerrymander, which is illustrated in part by the fact that this midterm election was a very blue year. At the statewide level, Democrats did very, very well. But even in that circumstance, the Republicans were able to hold on to majorities in both houses. And of course, that's part of the background here, because as Scott Fitzgerald has explicitly said, this was done in order to prevent the governor from bringing in a liberal agenda. But it gets to a larger point, which I think is complicated. Because Matt referred to a gerrymandered legislature as not accountable to the people, but it sort of depends on how you think about the people. If you think about the people as the population of Wisconsin, then that's absolutely true. But I mentioned earlier Governor Walker's comment that, well, these were just voters in Milwaukee and Madison. There is a kind of federalism-based idea that says, well, we represent geography. The north of the state needs to have as much state say in affairs as the south of the state, or the rural districts need to have as much say as the urban districts, and that these priorities exist entirely separate from the question of how many people live there. And that really fundamental and basic question of representation underlies the controversy over the gerrymander, and that in turn is what creates the political background for this constitutional crisis, if there is one. So in terms of what is the most significant constitutional issue, I think focusing on the changes with respect to the Attorney General is exactly right.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Howard, thank you so much for joining us. Great conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, and he's an expert in constitutional law, judicial politics, and American politics. Next up, we're talking books that somehow managed to land on the bestseller list when they came out. We'll talk about the books we most remember and tend to be the ones that didn't care about much at the time. That's coming up here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There's a curious thing about books that become bestsellers. Sometimes their path to greatness is long and winding. There can be this divide between books that sold well in any given year and the books that we now consider to be notable contributions to literature. Emily Temple has been writing about the strange gaps and studying the historical trends from Publishers Weekly. She's a senior editor at Lit Hub. Her recent piece is called Here Are the Biggest Fiction Bestsellers of the Last 100 Years, and her first novel, The Lightness, is coming out in 2020. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So you looked at the top 10 fiction bestsellers from 1918 to the present, and you decided to put them next to the most famous books to come out each year, the ones we might consider classics. What did you find?
Well, I found a lot of different things. I mean, the reason that I even had the idea to do this was because I was working on an entirely different piece where I was going through the books that defined the decades as far as we consider that now. And I really found this dissonance often, and sometimes not, but a dissonance between the books that were selling and so were influencing the culture at the time, one imagines, And then the books that we now look back and say, oh, 1925, The Great Gatsby. That's the biggest book that year, because that's the book we remember now. But no one read The Great Gatsby in 1925.
But sometimes these books perhaps just take some time to get where they are just notable contributions to literature. What's happening in that time?
I mean, again, it depends on the book, the books take many different paths to get to be classics of literature, a term we can also unpack. I mean, what makes any piece of literature a classic or not? Often what will happen is a book will be well reviewed and well considered, but not interesting to the public at large as much as another book, say. But then the Academy will take it up, and so people will study it in colleges, and it'll get treated as a work of literature that's worth academic study, and then that will sort of bring it in as a classic. In the case of The Great Gatsby, that was just sort of came out to mixed reviews. People didn't like it as much as Fitzgerald's first novel, and it didn't become a popular book until it was sent over. It was one of the books that was printed and sent over to American soldiers during World War II. And, I don't actually know who selected it, but it was one of a number of books that were selected. And so when these soldiers came back, they all loved The Great Gatsby.
And that was a massive audience of service members there who are reading the same thing.
Exactly. So, I think in 1945, 123,000 copies had been distributed. And by 1960, The Great Gatsby was selling 500,000 copies a year. Mm. So it's just interest that fuels interest. And then The Great Gatsby doesn't show up on this list. It was published in 1925. It doesn't show up on this list until 2013. When the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio comes out.
So certainly there are a lot of contributing factors, perhaps even when a book becomes a paperback or word of mouth. Can that impact a book becoming a bestseller many years later?
Oh, certainly. Paperback releases, films, sometimes someone dies and then we go back to their work, or we go back to a biography of them, et cetera. It can really be, and I think word of mouth, as you say, is extremely important, because so much of, I think, the culture of reading literature is recommending books. I mean, I recommend books for a living, and the only thing that ever gets me to read a book is someone pressing it into my hand and saying, you must read this.
And, it's tempting to just attribute this trend to people not understanding difficult fiction or not wanting to engage with high art, so to speak, high literature. We'd rather read John Grisham. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think that it's a little watery to talk about. I mean, sure, there are some things that are clearly high literature and some things that are clearly not. There's a lot that's in between. I think people come to literature for different reasons. And some people do just want to read John Grisham and it's entertainment, and there's no problem with that. Other people want something else from literature. So the books on these lists, they're the biggest bestsellers in this country of the year. Plenty of literary novels can rise the bestseller list for a little while or, a few weeks or a few months. And you also see great literary novels on this list. So it does happen sometimes. But it's true that when a book is really the top selling book overall of the year in this country, that means that it appealed to a ton of different people. And some of the, difficult books, not everyone wants that. But everyone wants a good story. I mean, everyone is interested in something that is going to entertain you. So, I think it just means that it appeals to a lot of people, and that's actually good, not bad.
Do we become more interested in perhaps a piece of literature when a certain author, after they die, is it something where we can look back upon an author's work, an author's body of work, so to speak? I'm thinking maybe about James Baldwin.
Yes, and in this year, in particular, James Baldwin has risen in the cultural imagination, in part because we are in a cultural moment where people are looking back to James Baldwin and thinking about the things that he said and applying it to the current time. Oh. So I mean, that's another way that books can come back. Suddenly we say, oh, this is really relevant to us right now. We also have a movie, a new James Baldwin movie, which is wonderful. By the way, everyone should go see it if Beale Street could talk. Mm-hmm. And so you're exactly right that things that happen in the culture, someone dies or something, you know, something politically that are not at all related to the book can bring back the book for a large number of people.
So reading and thinking about books and writing is your job. Was there anything you took away from scouring the Publisher's Weekly list that surprised you when you were looking at all of these books from the past 100 years?
You know, the thing that really surprised me, and this is very basic, but I was surprised by the fact that there are so many books that we have forgotten about that people loved. And there's no way to read all of these books. I mean, there's over 1,000 books on this list. Mm. But I'm really surprised by that, by the fact that there were all these books that meant so much to so many people, or at least enough for them all to go out and buy them. And our scope of what we consider to be great, what we consider to be classics, is just so small. And it makes me want to go back and try to read every single one of these books, but I do not have time.
Well, it also shows that in any time and point in history, we're focused on that time, and then that time is past. It's old history, perhaps, and we're thinking about something new, something different in society.
Exactly. And I have to say, I was also impressed by some of the older years. They did a good job. They read some great books back then. And we have done a good job too. In the most recent year, which is 2017, one of the books on the list was George Saunders, who is a wonderful literary writer. And another one was Colson Whitehead. So in 2017, number two was Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad, and number nine was George Saunders' Lincoln and the Bardo, which is an extremely difficult book. So good job, everyone.
Well,
you worked hard.
Emily, thank you so much for the pat on the back, and thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Emily Temple is a senior editor at Lit Hub, where she wrote the piece, "Here Are the Biggest Fiction Bestsellers of the Last 100 Years." Just ahead, we hear why the chair, yes, the chair, is the ultimate symbol of humankind. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.